We're glad that you folks are back. A lot of you have been gone. Some of you have been in the area, but you've just been kind of scattered out throughout the summer, traveling a lot. People have been taking classes different places. Max has been almost all over the entire world this summer. Just about, is that about right? Something like that, right. Just ask him how many countries he went to, and then you'll be shocked. I spent the summer engaging in pneumonia, so that was fun. It's a great diet plan. I lost 15 pounds in about 4 days, and but I think you should probably, if someone offers it to you, you should just politely decline, you know, in light of my experience with it this summer. So we are glad that the year has begun. And we're glad that you could be here. If you're new, we hope this is a place that you'll be able to feel connected, a place where you feel like you can, people can pursue God deeply, where when they have a deep relationship, and a place where people that are trying to figure him out and decide what they want to do with that can do that as well, and everything in between. That's always what we've tried to have NLCF be. I'm Jim Pace. I'm one of the pastors and our elders, depending on your lingo and how you talk wherever you're from. And we're just glad that you're here. And we're starting this series, or this semester, with a series on Virginia Tech's Principles of Community. And I've gotten a lot of responses. It's a series I'm actually pretty excited about. But I've gotten a lot of interesting initial responses when people hear that that's what we're doing. They'll say, why are you doing that? That's one of their responses. And we'll get into why in a few minutes, and hopefully it'll become a little more self-evident as we go. Other people have felt like it almost feels wrong if you're at a church and you are listing values of a secular university. It just doesn't feel like the right thing to do. And it feels like maybe we're more interested in making people good Hokies than good followers of Jesus. And some people have asked me, which would you rather people be, a good Hokie or a good follower of Jesus? And I was like, well, yeah, I'd like both. You know, I think that if we had to say which one is more important, there's no question. Our relationship with Christ is the most central piece of who we are. So if you only get one, you take that one. But I think that as we follow Christ, what we start to see is that we become people that embody these things. Just because a secular university came up with some principles doesn't mean they're all wrong. And I don't think these are. And I think as we look at them, what we'll see is that they actually will give us another reason to try to move towards God and to try to look at the world through his lens more and more. That's the goal. And hopefully we hit it. You know, we'll see how it goes. But what I want to do is I want to start with some old Testament. Not like recent old as in, you know, just 2,500 years ago, but old Testament, like Genesis 1, Old Testament. And this is Genesis 1, 26. What it says is, then God said, let us make man in our image, in our likeness, and let them rule over the fish of the sea and the birds of the air, over the livestock, over all the earth, and over all the creatures that move along the ground. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him, male and female, he created them. And then in verse 31, God saw all that he had made, and it was very good. You know, in this particular section of Scripture, the first couple of chapters, first few chapters of Genesis, what God is trying to do is, he's trying to answer a question that the Israelites were asking, all right? When Israel left Egypt and they, you know, went back to Canaan, this land that God had given them before, and then they had left because of a famine. And so he was essentially bringing them back to it, and they got there once, and they thought, oh, it's too tough, we can't do it, God. Sorry. And then so we let them wander around and rethink their decision. And so they rethought it for a few years, and then they were getting ready to go back into the land. When they were getting ready to go back in, that's when this was written. Okay? And so what they were wondering is, all of these people around us, they have this this story, these evolved stories about how their gods became their gods. You know, we're familiar with Roman gods, or especially Greek gods, and there's kind of this whole pantheon. There's this whole hierarchy of gods, and you got the low-level gods, the ones that, you know, nobody likes, and, you know, then you got the mid-level gods, you know, mid-management, and then you move on up, and these gods are constantly moving up and down the ladder. And when you look at them, and when you look at what they're like, they're kind of exaggerated forms of people. They do basically what people do, just in exaggerated ways, with the power that they have, and that's because people invented them. And so they have these stories. All these cultures around them, all these countries have these stories of God. And Israel, I think, is going, well, what is ours? How did God get going? Is it like them? And so the first few chapters of Genesis is God saying, this is how it is. I've just never not been. I've always been. And that is hard to kind of wrap my head around, because I'm used to, I mean, my entire existence has been in time, either in the past, present, or future. And so to imagine something that is outside of it, I can't quite get there. But he's saying, I've always been. And then I created you. I made you. He's saying to the Israelites, with the idea that they would say to the countries around them, even though it didn't happen that way. And then through the Holy Spirit, he's saying it to us, I made you. Specifically, each one of us is, we bear his likeness. We have his thumbprint on us. We are like him in some way. So that is kind of where we start. Now listen to the first principle of community. And again, you know, you go to tech, if you don't go to tech, if you, you know, the reality is I defy you to try to find something that this is like, oh no, this is bad. I shan't do it. The first principle is we affirm the inherent dignity and value of every person and strive to maintain a climate for work and learning based on mutual respect and understanding. I mean, it's hard to argue that, isn't it? Like, no, I don't want that. No inherent dignity for you. I'm sorry. No, yeah. But we affirm the inherent dignity and value of every person and strive to maintain a climate for work and learning based on mutual respect and understanding. Those words, inherent dignity and value, kind of jumped off at me. You know, we understand what it means to have or to grant dignity and value, but I think we have a little harder time with that first word, the inherent part of it. You know, culturally for us, dignity and value is something that we give based on something else. Okay? Respect is used later on. We do the same thing with that. Where what we do is we say, based on what you're doing, or based on what you've done, or based on who you are, or based on how you look, or based on how you're dressed, or what kind of job you have, or what coffee shop you go to, or where you buy your produce, or whatever, you know, it's like we give value based on that. If you do the things that I do, you get more. If you do things that I think are wrong, you get less. If I think something that you do is wrong, you give it less to me. And what we end up doing is we have this value system for people that's kind of going all over the place, all the time. In the reality of this, there are few places in life other than at a university or in a university town where you're able to be around this many people that have this many different stories than we do. Maybe a large urban center, if you work in a big, you work with a very big company, you might bump into this later on in life. But the reality is, we have the opportunity to be in very close proximity with an interesting cross-section of our world. And there are going to be people in that cross-section that we're going to meet, and within 5 minutes, we are going to be able to finish one another's sentences. And there are going to be people that we meet in that cross-section of the world that we're going to look at them and think, what the mess are you talking about? So when we talk about dignity and inherent and value and respect, we are not saying that's the same thing as agreement. When we talk about these things, we're not saying that we are going to automatically and completely agree with the things that other people decide. It doesn't mean that I'm going to look at different aspects of anybody's life, or they're going to look at mine and say, that is precisely the way I believe a human being ought to live and think. It's not based on agreement. But what we do is we do that. We base it on agreement. And then what we do is the way that we decide whether something is good or not is typically based on cultural norms. Right? We kind of look at what is going on generally around us. It might be Western culture if we look at it in kind of a macro, or the developed world, and then Western culture. And then we might look at it in sense of American culture, if that's where we're from. Then maybe Virginia or Southwest Virginia, where I grew up, where, you know, it was culture, but I didn't really get into it. You know, and you know, we can kind of go all the way down and even into just small pockets within a certain area. If you don't believe that very small groups of people have cultural norms, and if you bump up against them, you're going to pay for it, then I would argue that, or I would suggest you take a Starbucks mug into Bolo's right down the steps and just see kind of what happens. If the right people are working, you may not make it out. I'm just telling you right now. You know, what we do is we take the norms around us, and that defines value, what we value. And then we rate one another based on those things. Problem. There is a problem. The problem with that. So those values change. They change over time. They change over area. They're not predictable. So if we're connected to what culture feels like is good or not, we're going to be zigging and zagging all over the place. And if you would like an example of this, I will offer you the example of the world of fashion. Like ZZ Top needed to be done right there. I don't even know how many people know ZZ Top? Thank you. Okay, good. I start to feel old a lot more now that I'm older now. But if we were going to introduce ourselves to the average 1840s-esque hipster, then and we were to look at what he wore back in the day, to just put it all out there, which is what this guy is doing. You can tell because the foot is out, the arm is up, and he's even got something. I don't know if you can tell. He's got something in his hand. I love that if you're posing, I almost fell over. I don't know how he had that picture made, because I would have tipped. Maybe that's what the guy in the back is like. He's falling. But, you know, he's like, I'm getting my portrait done, and you know what? I need to grab something to eat right now, because I'm awesome enough that that's what I do. Now, this guy, he was very stylish in the mid-1800s. He really was. He had, I mean, foot to head, this guy had it. The first thing you notice are his shoes. They were pointy-toed, and that was pretty common back then. This is the forerunner of the Hessian boot, if you're familiar with that. And the pointy toe was helpful because it just slid into the stirrup nice and easy. But he wanted to do something a little extra. Again, he's putting it out there. And so what he did to make his shoe more masculine is he put a big heart on the top of it. I don't know if you can see it. It's there. That was. If you wanted to kind of be masculine, throw some hearts on some stuff. I mean, that's how it was. I can't imagine what they would have done if we had invented the bedazzler back then. I can only imagine. But, you know, so he's got the hearts because he wants to dude it up a little bit. And then you kind of work your way up, and he's got some velvet breeches. All right? Now, I don't know if you've ever worn breeches. When I'm home, that's all I'm in. All right? And they're harder and harder to get now. But he's wearing velvet breeches, and then he works up. He's got a cravat. It's, you know, right where his shirt opens, and there's so much masculinity in there. It's just like going, pow, it's coming out. And so he needs a little cravat to hold it in. keep some of that masculinity. And then the reason we know this is 1840s, and the reason that, you know, I did way too much research on fashion in the mid-1800s, is that he's wearing a cloak. Around 1850, he went to an overcoat. So he had the full-on cloak, and maybe this is from 1870, and he's wearing an ironic cloak. But I think, you know, he's got it. He's wrapping up in there. This was what was considered masculine, manly. This is what you did. This was their value. There's a quote from Samuel Johnson. I love this quote. Greek is like lace. And I'll be taking Greek soon, so I will see what this does. Greek is like lace. Every man gets as much of it as he can. Lace was a very masculine thing. Now, we get that fashion changes. We get that, right? We've seen it. But what's interesting, and I think what's important about this as an example of something that is much more important and much more broad, is that lace hasn't fundamentally changed. Guys' bodies needing to be covered has not fundamentally changed. But the opinion of what is good and what is masculine and how you do it and what is considered fashionable has. In 1840, that guy walks in and everybody's thinking, oh, I like that. That guy's got it going on. I mean, you know, velvet breeches, absolutely. Hearts on shoes, bring it. I'll get that cloak. You know, I mean, the whole thing. If he walked in today, we'd look at him like, you've got to be kidding me. You think he was going to a Ren Fair or something like that. You know, it's just, it wouldn't fit. Because we have jagged so far away from that, that what was considered valuable is now considered invaluable or funny. Now, if it's fashion, that's fine. We can do that. When it deals with things that are much more important, you can't. You can't. See, that's why the principle drops that word inherent in it. And that's why Genesis 1 makes the point that it does. In this case, the two things line up fairly well. You know, we're doing a little something where we have some swag for you guys tonight. So we have sunglasses. So, and they have UVI protection, which is good against ultraviolet rays. Who wants some? Let me see. Okay, there we go. We're going to start. I didn't throw very well this morning. All right, there we go. I'm going to work around. You're going to want to watch me because I'm really not good. All right, now here's what I want to do. I want to go back. I want to see what I can do. And so everybody underneath this, keep an eye out because who knows? So who wants it? Give me a target. All right, there we go. All right, Curtis. I don't know what's going to happen here, everybody, so let's just hope for the best. Oh, sorry. That was the wind. It was the wind. Hit a bird. You know, we'll give out some more of these later, but when we think about the way that we assign value, it almost functions with us the same way that sunglasses can work. You know, when you put on a pair of sunglasses, they don't fundamentally change anything about the day. Yeah, it's fun to watch a little kid when they put on sunglasses. I don't know if you've ever seen it. They'll put them on, and they'll take them off really quick, and they'll put them on and take them off. You know, they keep trying to figure out, how does it get dark so fast, and how does it get bright so fast? And we get silly children. You know, we get what they're doing in a second. Sunglasses don't work like that. They don't change what's going on outside. They change what gets in. They block certain bands of UV light. They tint everything down so that it's just the image that comes in is darker. And in some cases, if it's polarized, all these little bouncing light rays, they kind of pull it into line and only let in certain ones. They take what's already going on out there, and then they give us a different image. They affect what we see, but they don't change anything else. And what can happen with us is we can use social norms, whether you're good at something, or whether you believe something, or whether you don't believe something, or whether you practice a particular behavior or you don't. We look at all of this, and what we do is we set someone's value based on what gets through the lens. Now, just to drive this point into the ground, I want to read you 1 Samuel 16. It starts out with, "But the Lord said to Samuel, don't consider his appearance or his height, for I've rejected him." And what this is getting at is Israel, they noticed that every country around them had a king. And that was like a sign that you were a legit country. Until then, you were just kind of renting. You know, you weren't really, you weren't a full country back then unless you had a king. And so they started asking God, "Give us a king. We want a king." And back then, God didn't speak to each person that had a relationship with him the way that he does with us. What he would do is he would use a prophet. There would be one or two people at a time, and he would talk to them, and then they would distribute what God said. So people would come to Samuel, and they'd say, "Tell God, we want a king." And he would tell God, and God would say, "Tell them, no." And he would tell them, and they'd say, "We still want one," you know? And it just kind of went back and forth, and finally God said, "Okay, you want one? He's going to abuse his power. He's going to mess with you. You've already got a king. It's me." Hello? You know, "But if you want one, I'll do it." So we gave him one. And there was Saul. He was the first king. And Saul started out really, really well. I mean, really well. You'd almost start to think that the Israelites were right and God was wrong. Because this guy he wasn't doing all the stuff that they were afraid he would do, but you give any person enough power for a while, it is tough to say no to that power. And so Saul kind of got lured in, and he started doing everything that God said. And it got to a point, it got bad enough where God said, "Okay, enough. You are no longer the king. I'm going to anoint someone else." And he told Samuel to go out and anoint him. So Samuel, God says, "Okay, it's from this particular family. I want you to go out there, and one of the sons is going to be the king. I'll tell you who." So Samuel goes out. And even after the example of Saul, you know what Samuel does? He looks at the person that he thinks is the most valuable based on his physical characteristics. He's tall, and he's big, and he's good looking. It's like I was there. Flowing hair. I mean, it's weird reading this sometimes. But what he says is, "The Lord said to Samuel, don't consider his appearance or his height, for I've rejected him. The Lord doesn't look at the things man looks at. Man looks at the outward appearance. The Lord looks at the heart." We look on the outside. That's how we decide whether you're valuable. Do you look the right way? Are you shaped the right way? Are you good at the right things? Do you agree with me enough? I assign value based on that. God says, "Don't." That's what people do. Do it the way I do it. I look at the heart. We're going back to Genesis 1. It says, "Then God said, let us make man in our image, in our likeness, and let them rule over the fish of the sea and the birds of the air, over the livestock, over all the earth, and over all the creatures that move along the ground." My wife would argue that the way that we show dominion over the creatures that move along the ground is stomp as many of them as we can. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. God saw all that he had made, and it was very good. Things are kind of loud when they start moving, aren't they? What he did from the very start is he established a way of showing value. And it does not involve the things that we make it involve. It's deeper than that. Your value and my value is not based on how we look or how smart we are or how good we are at a particular thing, how much money we have, or whether we rock velvet breeches when we're at home or we don't. It's not based on that. It's based on one simple thing. And this is where that word inherent comes in. The thing that it's based on is based on the fact that we are all in one category. In this sense, we've all been made by God. And so everybody that I look at is under that same, has been made that way. Psalm says that we are fearfully and wonderfully made. And there is not a single person, regardless of how nice they are to me or mean they are to me, regardless of how much I agree or don't, regardless of any of that, there is not a single person that I walk around and bump into, see, think about, read, hear, get a blog of, watching a movie, anything, that is not that way. Again, this doesn't mean we're going to agree. This doesn't mean that we're going to see eye to eye on everything. This doesn't mean that we're going to be able to finish each other's sentences after 5 minutes. It doesn't mean that. It just means that as we're going through life, dealing with the people that we have, dealing with the things that we like and the things that we don't, it means that your value and my value is not on the table. It's just not. So we can't look down at anybody. The thing that my middle school daughter, Emma, needs to know the most is her value is not based on what the mean girls say. And you and I need to hear the same thing. Our value is not based on what society says. Not all of the societal norms are bad. This is not anti. I'm just saying that's not inherent. That's not deep enough. God is moving us towards something more profound, more stable, more equalizing. That is what we're saying. So here's what we'd like to do. What we'd like to do is, we'd like you to, as you leave, in a few minutes, we'll have a couple more worship songs, let's run the bucket, do a few things like that. We've got some food left. You guys have been eaters tonight. Good job. All right? I feel like my grandmother. Good job. You wait well. Okay? If I was really like my grandmother, I'd ask you about your bowel movements later, but I'm not. That just makes it weird. And I might have already done it anyway, right? But when you leave, we'd like you to grab a pair of those sunglasses. They say Imago Dei on the side. It just means the image of God. And what we'd like you to do is to wear them. It's the funny thing about sunglasses. They only work if they're worn. But as you're wearing them, it's just a bit of a practice to start looking at people the way that God would have us look. And so what we'd say is, instead of using the normal lens that we've learned over our entire lives of determining value and adjusting value and all of that, what we're going to do is we're going to try to take on God's lens. And everybody that we see through there, we are going to, in some way, we're just going to try to say, you know, you're valuable. You were made by God just like me. You are not better or worse. You have inherent value. Because God made you. And that's it. I found when I try to do it, it's harder than it seems like it would be. Because those natural categories that I can apply very quickly still happen. They're not magic sunglasses. Truth be known, they're kind of cheap sunglasses. There's no magic. It's too expensive. We tried to get it, but it's just there's too many of them. What we would do is we would try to look through them. And instead of trying to be more comfortable with just how we are, we would say, no, I'd kind of like to be more like God in this one. Because the more that we look at people like God, the easier it is to do that stuff. The easier it is to assign inherent value and respect. Whether you agree or disagree, it's just easier because you just are looking at someone that has been as fearfully and wonderfully made as you have been. It just makes being a hater harder. I like that. So we'd like you to try it. Now, if you're up for an additional challenge, when people come up to you and they say, Imagio Dei, and that's probably what some people will say, what is that? Then tell them that it's something that we're doing as a church to try to remind everyone, or to remind ourselves, don't remind everyone, that makes you kind of a jerk. Just, if they ask, you can tell them, but, it's like, no, I look at everybody right. You don't, though. You suck. You have less value. You've violated your own thing. But what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to look at people the way that God does. You can personalize it, do what you want to do. But just consider when people ask you what that means or ask you where you got those very expensive designer sunglasses, just tell them, this is just the main point of these is so that I can look more with God's eyes than with mine. It's worth a shot. I found that if all I do is come in a room and sit and listen to someone with a microphone, talk about whatever they're talking about, and then I leave and I get back in normal life, I can forget everything that was so beautifully orated in that room within half an hour. And then it's gone. I have to do things to bring it in because I don't want to just be the way I am. I want to be more like God. I want to live more like Christ. So let's try doing this together. And let's see what happens. All right? How's that sound? Is that good? A lot of reflective nods. All right. Well, that's good. We'll take a reflective nod. Well, let me pray. And as I'm going to just take about 30 seconds and just kind of be quiet. And what I'd like you to do is I'd like you to try to picture a group of people that it's going to be hard for you to look at through those lenses or not, and not kind of judge them. Certain groups of people that just make us a little bit angrier. Or when we picture a particular group of people, it just makes us mad. You want to look at them the same way. So just take about 30 seconds and think about who that might be and ask God to let you see them the way that He does. Honestly, for me, one of the hardest ones for me to apply this to is just my dad. It is hard to think of him and do anything but get mad. But God made him too. And I don't want to hold that. So I'm going to be thinking about him in a second. Think about whoever it is or what group it is and ask God to give you the strength just to see them the way that He does. And I'll pray in a single moment. God, I just ask you to help us to figure out how to do this. Lord, we don't want to assign value to people based on just cultural norms. They change too much. It's not stable enough. And we don't want to assign value to people based on how much we agree with them, whether they do what we do or if they don't do what we do. It's not how we want to be. It makes us defensive and angry. God, we're not reading these principles of community just so that we can align more with something that Tech happened to write. In this case, these principles, what Tech wrote, happens to be something that you very much want us to be. And so we're going to use them as kind of some guardrails to get there. Be more like you. So just take 30 seconds and picture who. And ask God to help you to look at them differently. God, help us look at those people we just thought of through the lens of you. You created them. They're made from the same stuff as us. That's where their value comes from and nowhere else. Help us to live that, even starting this week. Please, Lord. Amen.